have sailed. I have moved about this world of ours, and ever in search of the finest of its kind, we bring you the tops in Spine Chillers.
And you are listening to Radio Masterpieces on Valley 103.1, serving Duval, Carnation, and Redmond Ridge.
Detour, there's a muddy road ahead, detour. Paid no mind to what it said, detour. All these bitter things I find should have read that detour sign. Headed down life's crooked road, lots of things I never know. And cause of me not knowing, I now find trouble got in the trail. Spent the next 5 years in jail. Should have read that detour sign. Detour, there's a muddy road ahead. Detour, paid no mind to what it said. Detour, all these bitter things I find. Should have read that detour sign. I got right to the place where it said about face. I thought that all my worries were behind. But the farther I go, the more sorrow I know. Should have read that detour sign. Detour, there's a muddy road ahead. Detour, paid no mind to what it said. Detour, all these bitter things I find. Should have read that detour sign. When I got stuck in the mud, all my hopes dropped with a thud. I guess that my heartstrings are made of twine. Had no willpower to get from the hole that I'm in yet. Should have read that detour sign. Detour, there's a muddy road ahead. Detour, paid no mind to what it said. Detour, all these bitter things I find. Should have read that detour sign. Should have read that detour sign. Should have read that detour sign.
This is Bruce Kaplan welcoming you back to another episode of Radio Masterpieces. And boy, do we have two wonderful masterpieces for you tonight. If you ever want to reach me, please don't hesitate to write to Bruce at RadioMasterpieces.com. I'll be sure and try to dig up on the radio archives what you want to hear. Anything from the 1940s to the early 1950s, we can usually get it for you. Tonight, we begin with a wonderful episode of Inner Sanctum, and we conclude with a program that was just like Inner Sanctum. It was called The Mysterious Traveler. They're both just mysteries that are so fantastically plotted, I think you'll agree. Well, now it's time to enjoy our great features from the golden age of radio. Again, if you have any questions for me, please don't hesitate to write to Bruce at RadioMasterpieces.com. Have a fantastic week, and thank you for tuning in.
The last thing I remembered was the gunshot, the thud of the bullet, and the burning pain in my stomach. Then everything got black. When I regained consciousness, my impression was of blinding whiteness, There, don't try to move, Mr. Sturgis.
Where am I?
This is the emergency ward of the General Hospital.
I felt no pain. Just an overall numbness. And a desire to sleep. Am I going to die?
Yes.
How much time have I got?
A couple of hours.
Doctor, I want to make confession. I want to confess to murder. I told the doctor about the money and Anoa. She was much younger than I. And she thought because I owned a little drugstore, I must be prosperous. And I suppose that's why she married me in spite of the difference in our ages. But there wasn't any money for fun or nice clothes. So she became restless. But I loved her. And I did my best. Until the other night, in the drugstore.
It's 12 o'clock, thank heaven. Time to close up, Alex.
5 more minutes, dear. Another customer might come along.
Just like an old man chasing pennies, never getting anything out of life.
Be reasonable, dear. I'm trying to make a living for us.
Is this your idea of a living? Is this what you promised me before we were married?
I know it's not what you deserve, Lenore, but someday...
Oh, you make me sick. I must have been crazy when I married you.
Lenore.
I'm going to say something I've had on my mind for a long time, Alex. Rather than go on this way, I'd prefer to be dead. Look at you. I don't have to put up with you. I'm still young, Alex.
So there it was. Out in the open. An old man with money would have been acceptable. But because I had no money, she was going to leave me. I wanted to plead with her. I would have gotten down on my knees. But before I could say anything, the street door opened. And a man stumbled into the store.
Oh, Alex, look!
Help me. Quick, I'm wounded.
I helped the man to a chair. He'd been shot in the chest, and the front of his coat was covered with blood. His breathing came hard.
Bullet, my chest. Patch me up.
I'm only a pharmacist. You need a doctor.
I'll call Dr. Johnson.
No, I don't want any doctor. I want you to help me.
Is it because doctors must report bullet wounds? Is that why you want a doctor?
Never mind my reason. I got plenty of dough. I'll give you $500 to take care of me.
Well, I'd better call the police.
No, lady, no. Look, mister, take care of me. Keep it quiet. I'll give you $1,000.
$1,000? Let me see the money.
Here's a $1,000 bill, but I got plenty more.
No, help me take him into the back room.
Oh, but Alex...
No, I'll take him myself. You get busy and wipe the blood off the floor.
Oh, no. No, you can't.
Wipe up the blood. Do as I say, Lenore.
What's taking you so long?
I'm looking for a certain medicine among these bottles.
Give me something to stop the bleeding. Hurry.
I'll be ready for you soon. Well, Lenore, did you get the floor clean?
Yes, it's clean. How is he?
He's in bad shape. Weak from loss of blood.
Alex, you haven't done anything for him yet.
Be quiet.
But you've been in here 5 minutes, and he's just like he was before. Alex, you're stalling. Alex.
Let him lay there.
But he's dying.
I know.
Alex, call the police.
No.
Are you going to let him die?
Yes.
But that's as bad as murder.
I didn't shoot him. It's not my fault if he dies. Lenore, he's got money. Thousands of dollars. No one knows he came here. This is our chance, Lenore.
What do you mean?
I'm going to let him die. Take his money, and then get rid of his body. He lay still. I stooped and went through his jacket. There was a wallet containing a few $1 bills and a driver's license, which I handed to Lenore.
His name is James Kirk. He lives in Hillsborough.
His pockets were crammed full of bills of large denominations. Lenore watched, fascinated, as I counted.
How much is it, Alex?
A little over $78,000. We're rich, Lenore.
I'm frightened.
There's nothing to be afraid of. All we have to do now is wait until he dies and get rid of the body.
Do you need me to help you?
No. I can manage alone. This body is heavy. Yeah. It's through the door.
Oh. Alex, he's still alive.
Yes.
What are you going to do now?
It'd be dangerous to wait here until he dies. Anyway, what difference does it make? He'll be dead when he goes into the water.
No. No, that's murder.
Call it what you like. We've gone too far now to stop. You wait in the car. I'm going to carry him to the edge of the pier and drop him over the side. He's gone. I watched Kirk's body sink into the water. I knew the current in the bay would carry it out to sea. One doesn't picture a middle-aged druggist committing a perfect crime. But I felt sure that I had done it. For I had Kirk's money, and it seemed that no one could connect his death to me. I rejoined Lenore in the car, started for home. After I'd driven for a few minutes, I noticed she was strangely quiet. What's the matter, dear?
Nothing. Nothing at all.
Something's troubling you. What is it?
Nothing.
You act as though you're afraid of me.
No.
You are afraid of me. Lenore, why?
I never saw you act this way before. Something's happened to you. You're different.
Oh, nonsense.
Don't you feel it, Alex? You're a murderer.
Lenore.
You wouldn't even wait until he was dead.
Listen to me, Lenore. Whatever I did for your sake. I wanted the money for you. So you could be happy.
Oh, how can I be happy with this thing hanging over us?
We had breakfast the next morning in absolute silence. Then Lenore went to open the store, while I wrapped the money in a parcel, took it to the bank, placed it in my box in the safe deposit vault. No one paid any attention to me. Although the bank was swarming with police detectives. From the bank, I went directly to the drugstore and found a man there waiting for me.
Mr. Sturgis?
Yes?
Biggert is my name. Mark Biggert.
What can I do for you?
I'm an insurance company detective, Mr. Sturgis. I'm investigating the First National Bank robbery for my company. I want you to tell me everything you know about that robbery.
He was a big man, but not fat, this detective. And although he didn't appear to be very intelligent, he had a look of cunning. His clothes were rumpled, and he rolled an unlit cigar around in his mouth as he spoke.
Suppose you start from the beginning, Sturgis.
There's nothing to talk about, Biggert. I don't know anything about the robbery.
You don't, eh?
No, I don't. Why should you come here annoying me with silly questions?
I'll tell you why I'm here, Sturgis. And then maybe you'll see your way clear to talk. You know the bank was robbed last night and the crook got away with better than $78,000?
Yes?
The night watchman was shot. He's in a coma now, but before he was shot, he shot one of the crooks.
What does that have to do with me?
I'm coming to you, Sturgis. I'm a slow man, but I'm thorough. Which is more than you can say for the harness bulls and the police force. Take those harness bulls. They didn't spot the trail of blood that wounded crook left when he ducked on the alley behind the bank. Funny thing, they clean missed it. But I noticed it, Sturgis. I followed it through the alley and straight up this street. And here's another peculiar thing. The trail ended right smack at the door of this drugstore.
Are you implying...
2 and 2 makes 4, Sturgis. As I said, I'm not a fancy-pants detective, but here's how I figure it. This Yegg was wounded. So he came in here and asked you to fix him up, which you did. In exchange, he gave you a nice big piece of the tape to keep your mouth shut. Am I right, Sturgis?
You're 100% wrong.
If you were smart, you'd talk now and save yourself a lot of grief.
I've got nothing to tell you.
Suit yourself, Sturgis. But here's my business card. In case you change your mind, you can reach me at the Hotel Empire. Oh, by the way, The company is offering a $5,000 reward for the return of that money.
I'm not interested. Good day.
Okay. It's your next, Sturgis. I'll be seeing you.
Alex, I heard what he said. He knows.
I should have thought of the blood outside.
Well, how can you stand there and act so calm about it? He knows, I tell you.
Take hold of yourself and know. He only suspects, and his suspicions aren't worth 2 cents unless he can produce evidence. Believe me, we've got nothing to worry about.
I was cocky then. Too cocky. Lenore was right. I was a changed man. That money had put iron into my spine. And then, that afternoon, I got the first of the phone calls. Hello? Sturgis Drugstore.
This is Western Union calling. I have a telegram for Mr. Alex Sturgis.
This is he speaking.
Will you accept the message over the telephone, Mr. Sturgis?
Yes, yes, of course.
The message reads as follows. Place the money in an envelope and mail it to box number 11, General Post Office. Don't fail to act as instructed because your future depends on it.
Is, that all?
That's all, Mr. Sturgis. There is no signature.
Thank you. Bye.
Oh, it was bad enough having that detective snooping around, but now this telegram. Oh, don't take any more chances, Alex. Send the money.
No.
Alex, please. I'm frightened.
Listen, Lenore. Calm yourself. It's perfectly clear what happened. One of the bank robbers came with Kirk as far as the store. He must have been frightened away by the police. Now he's using this method to get the money. But he won't get it.
Why? What are you going to do?
I'm going to put a wad of blank paper in an envelope and mail it to that post office box. Then I'll stand watch at the post office and see who claims it.
And then what?
That money means everything to us, Lenore. I've already killed one man for it. If necessary, I'll commit another murder. I placed blank strips of paper in an envelope and mailed the envelope to that post office box. The next morning, I went to the post office and stood near the window, waiting for someone to come along and claim the envelope in box number 11. Hours passed. I got hungry. My legs began to shake from exhaustion. But I couldn't leave that spot. I meant to stay there until...
What are you waiting here for, Sturgis?
A voice cut through my thoughts. I looked up. It was Kelly, the policeman. He was suspicious.
The clerk noticed you hanging around and called for a cop.
It's nothing, Kelly. I arranged to meet my wife here. She's late.
Yeah, I saw your wife through the drugstore window as I came up the street. She must have forgotten all about your appointment. You'd better get back to the store, Sturgis.
I couldn't stay there after that. I walked around the block. When I came back, the policeman had disappeared. I entered, went to the window, and asked the clerk if anyone had claimed the mail in box 11. He nodded. The letter was gone. My plan to discover the identity of Kirk's confederate had failed. There was nothing to do but go back to the drugstore. It was empty. I felt a sense of danger as soon as I entered. So I closed the street door quietly and walked as silently as I could to the door of the back room. It was open. And Lenore was at the telephone.
Hello. Hello, Empire? Hotel? Hello. Connect me with Mr. Biggert, please. Yes. Mr. Mark Biggert.
Hang up, Lenore.
Oh.
Hang up the receiver.
Alex!
You were calling that detective.
Suppose I was. What of it?
You were going to tell him about the money. You were going to double-cross me for the reward.
You're so smart, Alex. What are you going to do about it?
Lenore, don't you understand? I don't want the money for myself. I took it for you, to give you the things that will make you happy.
Big-hearted, unselfish Alex.
What are you laughing at?
I'll tell you why you took that money, Alex. You thought you could buy me with it. Well, you're wrong. I wouldn't stay with you if you had all the money in the world.
Oh, no. Would you leave me after all that's happened?
I'm packing up right now.
No.
You can't stop me.
I love you, Lenore. I did my best to hold you. If I can't have you, no one else will have you.
What do you mean? Alex, stay away from me.
I'm going to kill you, Lenore.
Alex, no. Don't.
I'm going to
kill you, my darling.
Let go of my throat. Alex,
She's dead. All men kill the thing they love. And I've killed you, Lenore. I felt empty. Drained of all emotion. I buried her body in the cellar of the drugstore. I was even a bit glad that it ended in this fashion. For now, Lenore would be with me forever. Did I say it was ended? I was wrong. I found no peace. For the very next morning, Bigot came to the drugstore.
Good morning, Sturgis. Nice morning, isn't it?
What do you want?
Just stop by to have a chat, Sturgis. I've been giving a lot of thought to the First National Bank robbery. You know, that night watchman came out of his coma this morning.
Why, tell me about it.
I thought you might be interested. Here's an angle, Sturgis. The watchman says the robbery was pulled by only one man. One single crook, and he was shot. Nice angle, isn't it?
Is it?
Yes, it gave me a new idea, Sturgis. Now, I'm no Sherlock Holmes, but I figure it this way. That crook came in here and asked you to fix him up.
We've gone through this before.
I'm going to take it a little further, Sturgis. The crook asked you to fix him up, but you got a peek at all that money. So you let him die, took the money, and disposed of the body. How's that for a theory?
Very clever. But can you produce the body?
No, the police haven't been able to locate it, but I'm not discouraged, Sturgis. Those harness bulls aren't very smart. I'll find that body.
And when you do?
I'm an insurance company, Dick Sturgis. I want that $78,000. When I find that body, I'll come around here and you'll cough it up.
I've told you before, I know nothing about that robbery or the money. Now I've got work to do. Suppose you run along.
Okay, Sturgis. So long.
Hello. Sturgis Drugstore.
Western Union calling. I have a telegram for Mr. Alex Sturgis.
This is he speaking. Read it to me, please.
The message reads as follows. Received your letter. Contents not what requested. Suggest you obey instructions. Same box number and post office. This is final.
Is there a signature?
No, sir. There's no signature, Mr. Sturgis.
I hung up. My head was reeling. But out of the confusion in my mind, one thought emerged. The night watchman had said Kirk had no Confederates in the bank robbery. Therefore, the person sending me the telegram must be Kirk. The salt water of the bay must have revived him. Kirk was still alive. I found Kirk's wallet on a shelf where Lenore had placed it the night all this began. From the driver's license, I copied his home address. I waited till after midnight and drove to Hillsboro, where I found Kirk's apartment in an old tenement building. The door was unlocked. I drew out my gun and entered. I meant to kill Kirk. I had to kill him. The living room was empty. No one was in the bedroom. I turned, walked back to the living room.
Drop that gun, Sturgis. Big, drop the gun, quick. I'm not taking any chances with you.
How did you know?
How did I know you were going to come here, Sturgis? Sit down in that chair by the table and I'll tell you.
You sent the telegram.
Yes, I sent them.
You got me to think that Kirk was still alive.
That's right.
And you followed me here. You trailed me.
It's all clear now, isn't it, Sturgis? You take two and two and add it up and it comes out four. Now, where's the money?
The money?
We're going to cut out the cute stuff, Sturgis. I want that money. Now, where is it?
It's in a medicine jar. On a shelf. In the back room of the drugstore.
All right, let's go, Sturgis. First you'll give me the money, then I'll take you down to police headquarters.
We drove to the drugstore. I led him into the back room. I knew exactly what I was going to do. On one of the shelves was a bottle of hydrochloric acid. Bigot thought it was the bottle containing the money. I reached up, uncorked the bottle, and flung the burning liquid into his...
Oh, I'm blind. I'll kill you for this, Sturgis. If I could only see you. Where are you, Sturgis? Sturgis! Sturgis, where are you?
I was huddled against the wall. He stood between me and the door, screaming in pain, firing his gun blindly. The first three shots missed, but the fourth bullet struck me in the stomach.
Oh,
The last thing I remember is Bigot running out of that room shouting for help. I lost consciousness soon after. When I came to, I found myself here in this hospital. You know the rest of the story, Doctor.
That's your confession, eh?
That's my confession.
Did you get all that down on paper, Mr. Bigot?
Got every word of it, Doctor.
Bigot, you... How did you get here? I thought... Hydrochloric acid.
You thought you blinded me permanently, but not enough of the stuff get into my eyes to do any real damage.
I... Oh, Lenore.
He's dead, Bigot.
I've seen a lot of funny cases in my time, Doc, but this beats them all. He's a man who commits murder to get a lot of stolen money for his wife. Then he kills his wife. And finally, he gets killed himself. And the money? The money is safe and sound in the bank safe deposit vault.
Murder is my business.
Our story tonight begins in a huge white mansion overlooking the Hudson River, some 50 miles above New York City. In a large, comfortable room, David Phillips, a slender, nervous man in his early 30s, is seated at a desk typing.
Dear Julia, a year has passed since we last saw each other, and I'm writing this letter with a hope that you will understand all that I'm about to reveal, and understanding will forgive me. I'm a writer, darling, and yet I find it difficult to put into words the horrible events of the past year. As they flash through my mind, I can feel the quickening of my pulse, and the hatred within me surges up as overwhelmingly as... But I mustn't think of that. It's much more important that you understand what has happened. It all began the day I was in my study, writing a script for the Dangerous Adventure radio show.
Darling, it's for you.
Who is it?
It's Basil King.
Basil King?
Dave, wait a minute. I want to talk to you.
But honey, Basil King, I can't keep him waiting.
Yes, you can.
Well, we'll talk fast.
King's looking for a writer for his radio show, isn't he?
Yeah, Sig Rodman just quit.
Quit? You mean he had a nervous breakdown? And so has every other writer who's ever worked for Basil King. Dave, I don't want you to write for him.
But, Julie, his show pays $600 a week. We could pay off all our debts with that kind of dough.
Darling, be sensible. No amount of money is worth the punishment you'll have to take from him.
Now, look, we'll talk about this later. He's on the phone.
Tell him no.
Shh, he'll hear you. Hello?
Mr. Phillips, this is Basil King speaking.
Oh, yes, Mr. King.
Several people have spoken very highly of you as a radio writer, and at the moment I'm in need of one for my show, Brad Barker, Private Eye. Would you care to discuss the matter?
I'd like to, very much.
Are you free for luncheon tomorrow?
Yes, I am.
Shall we say 1 o'clock at the Algonquin?
All right, Mr. King.
Just to ask for my table. Good day, Mr. Phillips.
Good day. Now, honey, don't look at me that way.
Dave, I just don't understand you. It doesn't make sense wanting to write for him. Everyone who's ever worked for Basil King detests him. He's the most hated man in radio.
Be reasonable, Julie. $600 a week is a lot of dough. If I can't get along with King, I'll quit. Now, what more can you ask? Next day, as the head waiter led me through the crowded dining room, I could see Basil King seated at a table in a far corner of the room. King was a tall, slender, gray-haired man in his late 40s. He had a cold, impassive face, and his movements were stiff and precise. It suddenly occurred to me that he bore an amazing resemblance to Clifton Webb, the Hollywood star. As I reached King's table, he stood up.
How do you do, Mr. Phillips? I'm Basil King. Have a seat, won't you?
Thank you.
I suggest we talk first and order luncheon later.
All right, Mr. King.
Now, Mr. Phillips, to begin with, I'm a man who believes in frankness. I dare say this frankness of mine has led to my making a large number of enemies, and has given me the reputation of being an extremely difficult person to get along with. No doubt you've heard quite a few stories about me.
Yes, I have.
Believe me, they're highly exaggerated. Great talents, such as myself, have always been misunderstood. The petty minds in this world, not understanding men of genius, are forever seeking to destroy us.
I see.
I wonder if you do, Mr. Phillips. I wonder if you do. I ask very little of my writers, merely a modicum of intelligence and the ability to accept constructive criticism.
That sounds reasonable enough.
Yes, one would think so, and yet I haven't been able to find a writer who understands me.
I'm sure you will sooner or later.
Perhaps, but to date it's been very discouraging. However, we mustn't dwell on the past. Now, Mr. Phillips, you come highly recommended, and I trust that ours shall be a happy and profitable relationship.
I hope so.
By the way, you aren't troubled by ulcers, are you?
Why, no.
Good. For some unfathomable reason, all the writers I've had in the past seem to have been afflicted with ulcers. I can't stand people who are always taking pills and subsisting on bland diets. Tell me, are you familiar with my show, Brad Barker, Private Eye?
Oh, yes. I've heard it quite often.
Good. Then you're undoubtedly aware that there are two things I insist upon in my shows. Clever plots and gimmicks that work. Bear that in mind, Mr. Phillips. Clever plots and gimmicks that work.
I understand.
It's on those two rules that I have single-handedly built the most popular detective show on the air. You have only to look at the Hooper rating of Brad Barker, Private Eye, to substantiate what I'm saying.
Yes, I know. You've got a terrific rating.
18.6. Needless to add, my sponsor, the Zestful Chewing Gum Company, has increased its sales tremendously. Now, Mr. Phillips, I'm prepared to pay $600 a week for the writing of Brad Barker. Is that satisfactory?
Yes, that sounds fair enough.
When may I expect your first script?
Well, let's see. Today is Wednesday. What about Monday morning?
That's satisfactory. Monday morning it is. Now, shall we order luncheon?
An hour later, Basil King and I separated in front of the Algonquin. I went home and started work on the script, determined to turn out a show that would make King sit up and take notice. After 4 days and nights of intensive writing, I completed the script. Monday morning, I went downtown to Basil King's luxurious office and turned the script over to him. As I sat by his desk, watching him read it, it was hard to tell what he thought of it. His face was cold and impassive as he turned page after page. At last, he finished reading it and looked up.
It won't do, Mr. Phillips.
It won't do? Well, why not?
First of all, you haven't caught the spirit of Brad Barker in your dialogue. But more important, the plot is weak and your murder gimmick won't work.
Well, I don't see why it won't. Would you mind explaining?
In this script, you have the victim, what's his name?
Charles Riker.
Yes, you have this fellow Charles Riker, whose life has been threatened, barricade himself in a small cabin. All doors and windows are locked from the inside, and in addition, he's armed to the teeth and has a watchdog with him.
That's right.
2 days after this fellow Riker has barricaded himself, Brad Barker breaks into the cabin to find him dead. Dead. Of poison.
Yes.
Your gimmick is that the murderer, unable to get at Riker, has tapped the water pipe which ran from the spring to the cabin and poisoned the water.
Yes, well, what's wrong with that?
My dear fellow, don't you think that when Riker drew a glass of water in the cabin, he'd have tasted the poison in the water?
But I planted in the script that the poison was tasteless.
Oh, you did. Well, nevertheless, it won't work.
Oh, why not?
It just doesn't ring true. I don't feel it.
Why not?
We should stop asking why not. It's obvious that I don't like your gimmick, and if I don't like it, 15 million radio listeners won't like it. If our relationship is to continue, you must learn to accept constructive criticism. After all, my dear fellow, you have merely to look at the rating of the show to realize that I am never wrong. Furthermore, I should like to point out that at no time...
Is that you, Dave?
Yes, Julie.
How did King like the script? He didn't like it.
That's putting it mildly.
Oh, but that was a good script. One of the best you've ever done.
That's what I thought. But Mr. King didn't.
No wonder all his writers have nervous breakdowns. That man doesn't know what he wants.
Well, I'll give it one more try.
You mean you're still gonna try to write for him?
Now, honey, there's no use in giving up so soon. Maybe once I get to know King's likes and dislikes, it won't be so tough to write for him.
Dave, I've never interfered before, but this is too much. I want you to call that egomaniac King up and tell him you're through.
Julie, I can't. I told King that I'd turn in another script by Thursday.
Oh, Dave.
I promise you that if he doesn't like the second script, I'll give up. Now, that's fair enough, isn't it? For the next 3 days and nights, I sweated over a new script. As I worked out the plot and gimmick, I tried to anticipate Basil King's every possible objection. Early Thursday morning, I went downtown to King's office and turned the script over to him. As he sat reading it, I began thinking of what I would say to him if he tried to show doubt. I would tell him quite firmly that it was obvious I wasn't the man to write the Brad Barker show. At last, King finished reading the script and looked up.
The plot, Mr. Phillips, isn't exactly new, and the dialogue needs rewriting here and there, but on the whole, it will do.
You mean you like it?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that I like it. Rather, let us say that it's acceptable. I trust, Mr. Phillips, that with time, your scripts will improve. Good day.
I left Basil King's office that morning convinced that I would succeed where other writers had failed. I felt it would be just a question of time until I learned the workings of King's mind. But then I discovered, as so many of my predecessors had, that Basil King's likes and dislikes were not constant from day to day. What he told you on Thursday didn't hold true on Friday. Weeks went by, and for every show that King accepted, he'd reject two. He would criticize every script from beginning to end, tearing it to bits relentlessly and coldly. Any questioning of his criticism would lead to his redoubling his attack. One week slipped into another, and with each passing week, my hatred for Basil King grew. Life became a nightmare of deadlines, of writing endlessly with one eye constantly on the clock.
Darling, you just can't go on this way. You've got to quit.
Julie, we've been over this a dozen times already. We need the $600 a week to pay off our debts.
What good is that money if you have a nervous breakdown? Look at yourself. You've lost 15 pounds in these past weeks, and you're smoking 5 packs of cigarettes a day.
Please, Julie, I've had all I can take today. Now, let's not talk about it anymore.
You're not kidding me, Dave. The money is only part of it. It's your pride that won't let you quit.
My pride?
Yes. You can't stand the thought of quitting like the others did. You've got to prove that you're better than they are.
That's enough.
Well, it's the truth, isn't it? It's only your pig-headed pride that makes you go on when anyone with sense would quit.
I said that's enough.
Dave, we can't go on like this.
What do you mean?
I'm not going to stand around and watch you have a breakdown. You'll have to choose between Basil King and myself.
Now, look, Julie, you're upset. You don't know what you're saying.
I know perfectly well what I'm saying. I'm asking you to choose between Basil King and myself.
Stop trying to intimidate me. I told you before I'm not quitting, and I meant it.
All right, Dave. If that's the way you want it, I'm leaving.
Well, go ahead. No one's stopping you. Basil King may be able to make you quit, but not me. You call it pride? Okay. But I won't let a louse like him beat me. Somehow I'll get the better of him. You wait and see.
Goodbye, Dave.
I was so emotionally worn out the night you left me, Julia. I could scarce comprehend my loss at the time. There seemed to be only two people in the world. Basil King and myself. As I traveled back and forth day after day between my typewriter and King's office, my hatred for him increased 100-fold. Feeling my hatred for him, King redoubled his sadistic attack, sensing that I was determined not to quit. The weeks slipped by, and the nightmare continued. King insisted that I come to all rehearsals of the show so that the cast, as he put it, might see the culprit who wrote the script. It was at a rehearsal that I first met Mr. Pearson, president of the Zestful Chewing Gum Company. He was sitting in the control room, watching with great respect as Basil King rehearsed the cast.
No, no, no. My dear Miss Hunter, I assumed when I hired you that you were a radio actress. If I'm wrong, please enlighten me.
I knew that was wrong, Mr. King.
I don't feel it. I just don't feel it. Try it again.
Rocky, you've got to give me a chance to explain. It wasn't my fault. Honest, it wasn't, Rocky.
Cut, cut. Miss Hunter, you sound too young. I want you to age the role 1 year. Mind you, just 1 year.
Yes. Rocky, you've got to give me a chance to explain. It wasn't my fault. Honest, it wasn't. Rocky, don't.
Cut. Well, if that's the best you can give me, it will have to do. And, Mr. Cooney, if you can't do better, I'll have to get another sound man. Take 15 minutes.
It's dreadful, Mr. King, the incompetence you have to put up with.
Yes, Mr. Pearson, it often amazes me that I've been as successful as I have. Oh, speaking of incompetence, Mr. Pearson, I'd like you to meet the present writer of the show.
How do you do, Mr. Phillips?
Glad to meet you, sir.
I have great hope, Mr. Pearson, of making a radio writer out of Phillips.
Well, I'm sure if anyone can do it, you're that person, Mr. King.
Pardon me, Mr. King. Would you like to hear the commercial now?
Yeah, very well, Caruso. Go ahead.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, July 8th is the big day. In just 1 month, you'll be able to buy the latest discovery in chewing gum happiness, Pepsogum. Made by the Zestful Chewing Gum Company, Pepsogum is a new gum. A gum with a jailed-in flavor, designed to give you hours of chewing pleasure. Remember, the big day is July 8th, when Pepsogum will be on sale at all candy counters.
I don't feel it, Caruso. I want more emphasis. I want you to be so compelling that people will rush to their drugstores and place orders for this new gum.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Rehearse it a few more times, and I'll go over it with you later.
Yes, Mr. King.
Well, I guess I'll be getting back to the office, Mr. King. Most kind of you to allow me to watch your rehearsal.
That's quite all right, Mr. Pearson.
It's a pleasure meeting you, Mr. Phillips. I assume that you'll be at the factory for next week's broadcast.
The factory?
Yes, Phillips. We're doing the broadcast in the factory next week.
Yes, it's the company's 25th anniversary. You've no idea how our employees are looking forward to your broadcast. Yes, indeed. Well, good day, gentlemen.
Goodbye, Mr. Pearson. Mr. Phillips, I have here the script you turned in for next week's show. It won't do.
Why not?
There are so many things wrong with the script that it's hard to know where to begin. Let's start with your murder gimmick. You have the victim, I believe his name is Roger Roden.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, you have this fellow Roden picking up an envelope, licking the flap and sealing the envelope. A minute later, he drops dead. Your gimmick is potassium cyanide. Powder has been mixed into the glue of the envelope flap.
Yes, and when Roden licked the flap, his tongue absorbed the poison.
It just won't stand up.
Why not?
For the simple reason that Roden's tongue wouldn't absorb enough potassium cyanide to kill him.
Oh, but it would. Potassium cyanide is a very potent poison. Just a few grains will kill a man.
Possibly, but I'm not convinced. And if you can't convince me, you won't convince our 16 million listeners. It just won't do.
It will work. I tell you, it will work.
I'm sorry, Mr. Phillips, but I don't agree. How soon can you have another script for me?
It was at that moment I knew I was going to murder Basil King. Perhaps all along it had been there, buried in my subconscious. For the first time in weeks, my hands stopped trembling, and I was able to think clearly of all that had happened. I had allowed Basil King, a man who was a psychopathic case, to drag me down to his own level. And what was worse, I had lost Julie. My stupid pride had driven the one person I loved away from me. Basil King would pay for that. And all the anguish he'd caused so many people. I thought of King's rejection of my potassium cyanide gimmick. And suddenly it came to me how ironic it would be if his death were brought about by potassium cyanide. Yes, the great man dying by a gimmick which he declared wouldn't work. Of course, I couldn't use the envelope flap, but there were other ways. And I would think of one. Now, that night, a plan began to form in my mind. A plan which was completed a week later as I was being shown through the Zestful Chewing Gum Factory by Mr. Morris, the superintendent of the factory.
I had no idea the factory was so large, Mr. Morris. We seem to have walked miles.
I'm afraid you radio riders just aren't used to walking. Probably ride in taxi cabs all the time.
I guess you're right. Oh, what's this place?
This is the shipping room.
Oh.
That about completes the tour. I reckon you've seen just about everything.
Say, all these boxes have Pepsogum marked on the side of them.
That's right.
You're getting ready to distribute it all over the country?
Yeah, we're going to start shipping next week.
You know, I've heard so many announcements on the show about Pepsogum that I'm curious. What's it taste like?
Well, it's hard to say. It has sort of a sharp flavor.
Sounds good. If you have any around, I'd like to taste it.
Well, I'd like to give you some, Mr. Phillips, but the old man, I mean, Mr. Pearson, he's given out strict orders not to give any of it out. Reckon he's trying to keep it from the public till the last minute.
Oh. But employees have tasted it, haven't they?
Oh, sure.
Well, Mr. Morris, you're looking at an employee right now. I do write radio shows for the company.
Yeah, I guess you are an employee after all. I reckon I can give you a pack of Pepsogum. There you are.
Thanks. An attractive-looking pack of gum.
Yeah, you gotta catch the customer's eye if you want to sell gum. Well, what do you say if we go back to the auditorium?
Fine. I've seen the whole factory, and I've got a pack of the new Pepsi gum. What more could I ask for? A few
few minutes later, I left Mr. Morris in the auditorium, where the great Basil King was rehearsing the cast for the show. I walked across the street to the inn where we were staying and went up to my room. There, I took the pack of Pepsi gum from my pocket and withdrew one of the 5 sticks of gum. I very carefully removed the wrapper, and taking a dampened handkerchief, I wiped the candy powder off the stick of gum. It took but another minute to evenly sprinkle potassium cyanide powder over the wet stick of gum. In a very short time, the gum dried, and it was impossible to tell that the fine, powdery coating on it was a coating of death. I rewrapped the stick of gum and carefully inserted it in the center of the pack. When I arrived at the auditorium 10 minutes before airtime, the great man was relaxing in the control room. With him were Mr. Pearson and Bill, the broadcast engineer.
Oh, there you are, Mr. Phillips. I was afraid you were going to miss the broadcast.
Mr. Phillips may not be a good writer, but he is a punctual one, Mr. Pearson.
Mr. King, you're a great one for banter. You have a ready wit.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson.
Look at that auditorium. Completely packed. I've never seen our employees so enthusiastic, and it's all due to you, Mr. King. I hope you'll say a few words to them after the broadcast.
Well, I should be delighted to.
Can you spare a minute, Mr. King?
What is it?
Do you remember that script I turned in a week ago with the potassium cyanide gimmick?
You mean where the victim licked the envelope flap and was poisoned? Yes, I remember that deplorable script. What about it?
Well, I was wondering, what if we were to switch the potassium cyanide to something else? Instead of the envelope, perhaps the cyanide might be sprinkled on a piece of candy or something like that.
No, no, no. It would never work. I don't feel it.
You really don't think it would, huh?
Certainly not. Really, Mr. Phillips, you're showing less and less imagination from week to week.
Well, I just thought I'd mention it.
Mr. Phillips, that pack of gum you have, isn't that the new Pepsi gum?
Yes, Mr. Pearson, that's right.
But I gave strict orders that it wasn't to be given out. How did you get it?
Yes, how did you get it?
I found this pack in the shipping room. I hope you don't mind my having taken it.
Well, no. After all, we are just one big family.
You see, Mr. Pearson, I've heard so much about the new Pepsi gum that I was curious to find out what it tasted like.
Well, what did you think of it?
Well, I haven't tried it yet, but I guess this is as good a time as ever. Have a piece?
Don't mind if I do. Thank you.
What about you, Mr. King?
No, thank you.
You mean you aren't even curious to know what Mr. Pearson's new gum tastes like?
Please, Mr. King, I'm very eager to know what you think of the flavor. I have great respect for your opinion.
Very well, Mr. Pearson.
Here you are, Mr. King.
Thank you.
I understand it has a sharp flavor, Mr. Pearson.
Yes, but delightfully so. Delicious. Well, I have a feeling that Pepsi gum is going to be a tremendous success. Go ahead, Mr. King. Put it in your mouth. I'm anxious to have your opinion.
Yes. Yes. Certainly has a sharp taste.
Oh, not that sharp. Keep chewing it. 1 minute's airtime, Mr. King.
Thank you.
I watched the great man, Basil King, chewing a stick of Pepsi gum. I knew that he found the flavor a bit sharp. And if Mr. Pearson hadn't been watching him, he would have spat it out. Yes, Mr. King didn't like the flavor, but with the sponsor looking on, he had to continue chewing. I watched the minute hand sweep around the clock. In 30 seconds, we would be on the air, and according to my calculations, Mr. King would keel over 15 seconds after we were on the air.
Stand by.
I'll give you the go-ahead, Mr. King.
Very well.
Coming up. Go ahead.
The Zestful Chewing Gum Company presents Brad Barker, Private Eye. Conceived, produced, directed, and edited by Basil King.
My dear fellow, the monitor is too high. That's it. Take it down. You engineers just don't know.
Oh, my heart.
Brad Barker,
King, what's wrong?
My heart,
Quick, catch him.
I've got him, Mr. Pearson. You'd better get a doctor. It looks like a heart attack.
Yes, I'll get one immediately.
Bill, turn down the monitor. Just do the best you can.
Okay, Dave. You take care of him, and I'll take care of the show.
King,
can you hear me?
Yes, get a doctor.
Do you remember the potassium cyanide gimmick?
Potassium cyanide?
Yes. I just want you to know you're wrong. It does work. That's why you're dying.
What?
That stick of gum I gave you. It was covered with potassium cyanide powder.
No, no. Get it off.
A doctor can't help you. You're going to die.
Oh, no.
Brad Barker, Private Eye.
poor Mr. King. You just forgot one thing. Murder is my business. Julie, darling, that was a year ago, and I've never ceased to regret your leaving me. I'm writing this in the hope that you will find it in your heart to forgive me. I admit that it was my stupid pride that wouldn't allow me to acknowledge defeat at Basil King's hands. But he's gone now, Julie. And if you could only see your way clear to start all over.
Hi. Hello, Mr. Phillips. Remember me? John Pearson?
Mr. Pearson?
Yes. You remember Mr. Morris, my factory superintendent?
Hello.
We happened to be driving past and thought it'd be a nice gesture to drop in and find out how you were getting along.
Please, I've got to finish this letter to my wife, Julia. I've got to finish it.
Doesn't seem to be getting any better, does it, Mr. Pearson?
No, it doesn't. Look at all these letters scattered around. Must be at least 100. All addressed to his wife.
What a pity, huh?
Yes, I'll never forget that day that Basil King died of a heart attack. I came back to the control room to find poor Mr. Phillips crying hysterically over the body. He never has gotten over the shock of Basil King's death. What a wonderful friendship that was.
Is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy's for sale. I must take a trip to California and leave my poor sweetheart alone. If he has a dog, he won't be lonesome, and the doggy will have a good home. How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy's for sale. I read in the papers there are robbers with flashlights that shine in the dark. My love needs a doggy to protect him and scare them away with one bark. I don't want a bunny or a kitty. I don't want a parrot that talks. I don't want a bowl of little fishies. He can't take a goldfish for a walk.
About this world of ours, and ever in search of the finest of its kind, we bring you the tops in Spine Chillers.
And you are listening to Radio Masterpieces on Valley 103.1, serving Duval, Carnation, and Redmond Ridge. The door is slowly closing for Radio Masterpieces, but be sure and tune in again next week from 9 to 10 p.m. to listen to more wonderful mysteries from the 1940s and 50s. This is Bruce Kaplan signing off. Radio Masterpieces is a Seattle Miracle Incorporated production.